sag for years from the accustomed weight of the chains. Why do you suspect Father was killed by someone other than Roger Rabbit?
Because of some things that don't figure. I consulted my notebook. For starters, the day he died, your father wrote a check to a gallery downtown, the High-Tone Gallery of Comic Art. Ever hear of it?
Little Rock laughed dryly.
I should say so. It's run by a fellow named Hiram Toner. He has a reputation as a somewhat less than ethical dealer.
Exactly what do you mean by that?
I mean, the provenance of his art warrants extremely close scrutiny.
Could you translate that into plain English for me?
I finally saw a resemblance to his father in the haughty way he peered at me down his nose.
He's a fence for stolen art.
I hauled out the photos I had found in Rocco's office. Recognize these?
He fanned them out card fashion in front of himself and kept glancing at me over their tops, like a riverboat gambler figuring out how to stick me with the old maid.
Where did you get them?
They were in your father's office. You know what they are? He laid them face up on the desk, arranging them into a pleasing pattern, the same way he would have had they been hanging outside on his gallery wall.
They were stolen from here about a month ago.
Any clue as to who did it?
None. I opened up one day, came in, turned off the burglar alarm, took a look around, and saw they were gone. They had been taken right off the wall during the night. The police investigated but could find no evidence of forced entry. We never did discover how the thieves got in.
Who had keys?
Only me. And of course, my father.
I turned the photos over. What about the prices on the back?
He perched a pair of tiny half-glasses on the end of his nose.
These prices are considerably lower than the works are worth.
As if the guy selling them might know they're hot?
Yes, that's likely the case, said Little Rock, especially at the High-Tone Gallery.
I returned the photos to my pocket. What about Jessica Rabbit? Your Uncle Dominic thinks she was taking your old man for a ride.
I couldn't remember right off where I had seen his expression before. Then I placed it. I once had a puppy in love.
Shows you how little Uncle Dom knows about women. Jessica is one of the most charming and beautiful ladies I've ever met. She was far better than my father deserved.
Chalk up another conquest for Jessica the Juggernaut. You have any idea who will inherit your father's estate?
No, although I suppose it will probably be me. I guess I'll find out for sure tomorrow, when they read the will.
He didn't seem particularly interested. Maybe he knew about the DeGreasy Syndicate's rotten financial shape, that he'd be lucky to inherit Carfare Home from the lawyer's office.
I asked him point blank the syndicate's net worth, but he insisted he had no idea. He contended that his father had always excluded him from the fiscal end of the business.
You know if your father had any recent dealings with someone with the initials S.S.?
S.S.? No, not that I know of.
I played a long shot. I notice from your sign out front that you represent Carol Masters, yet I don't see any of her works out on display.
How come?
Little Rock slumped down into his chair, as if somebody had yanked a cork out of his toe and deflated his body by 10 pounds.
Father told me to pull them.
Why?
Little Rock turned his beautifully manicured hands, palms up.
I'm not exactly sure. About 6 months ago, Father took a vehement dislike to the woman. I can only guess it's because lately Carol has become a forceful crusader for Toon's rights, and Father resented her for it. She led a contingent of Toons right into Father's office on a quest for higher pay scales and improved working conditions.
Lord, I wish I could have been there to see it.
I suspect that may have been the final straw. Shortly thereafter, Father began a concerted effort to strangle Carol's career. He spread the word that she had become unreliable,
that a high percentage of her work required extensive retouching. He even rejected one of her strips outright, and that's almost unheard of in the industry.
Did he have a case?
Not that I could see. Carol takes some of the best photos around. I had originally intended to feature her next month in a one-woman show, her first. I had invitations set, flyers printed. When Father found out about it, he was furious. He instructed me to cancel it, and what's more, to remove everything of Carol's from the gallery.
How did Carol react when she found out you were scrubbing her show and yanking her stuff?
How would you expect? She stormed out of here in a royal tizzy. That was yesterday. When I heard Father had been killed last night, my initial reaction was that Carol Masters had done it. I was actually quite surprised to find out it had been Roger Rabbit instead.
You consider Carol Masters capable of murder?
Most assuredly, especially if someone pushed her as hard and as far as my father did.
At first I guffawed. Then, when I remembered her eyes, her savage tiger's eyes, I realized that maybe, just maybe, Little Rock had a point. I played Clue with him for another half hour or so, but when I tallied up my score sheet, I found I was no closer to discovering who had killed Rocco DeGrisi with the gun in the study than I had been when I first walked in.
21.
In a contest for most signs in least space, I would have been hard-pressed to pick between Smokey Stover's firehouse and the front window of the high-tone gallery of comic art. Half off on this, close-out sale on that, invest in art for the future, with every S converted to a dollar sign. Toss in the loudspeaker blaring over the entry door, a half-mile of flashing neon out front, and a used car lot seemed practically staid by comparison. I barely got inside when two super-slick salesmen pounced on me, one from either side. For laughs, I almost passed myself off as a big spender, just to watch them arm wrestle each other over who saw me first. But instead, I flashed my license. That brought them to a screeching halt. I never heard so many hems and haws. Talk about guilty looks. Sylvester the Cat, with his mouth full of Tweety Bird, could do a better innocent act than these two clowns. I asked for Hiram Toner, and they pointed me toward the back. As I headed in that direction, I caught one of the salesmen tapping a wall-mounted button, probably connected to an alarm in Toner's office. Woe to the poor bunco cop snooping around here. Maybe Toner was compulsively neat. Maybe, more likely, he was Jack Flash with a shovel and pail. Whichever. By the time I got to his office, there wasn't a scrap of paper to be seen anywhere. His decor could have been designed by Goldilocks and the Baby Bear. Furniture not too hard, not too soft. Lighting not too bright, not too dim. Temperature not too hot, not too cold. But everything just right. Toner greeted me warmly with an outstretched hand.
"Hiram Toner," he said. "Pleased to meet you."
Give Toner a swig of Little Rock's red liquor, and you could have used him for a thermometer. I'd seen cadavers with more padding on them. His suit looked to be expensive, but still fit him like a grocery sack fits a buck's worth of canned soup and bananas.
"How may I be of assistance?"
he said, with a voice oily enough to fry a chicken.
"Wait, let me guess. You're here to see about buying an original strip, but which one?" "Ah, I know. Prince Valiant. Definitely Prince Valiant. It so suits you. Stately, with an aura of chivalry."
"Sorry. If you're going into the Swami business, you need a new crystal ball."
"Tarzan, then. I can see it in your rippling muscles."
"Wrong again.
Jungle Jim, Black Hawk, Superman, the Incredible Hulk."
"Knock off the snappy patter, Toner. I'm no sidewalk sucker. You know it as well as I do. My name's Eddie Valiant." I showed him my license, and he copied off its number. The man had gone round the block with gumshoes before. "I'm a private detective investigating Rocco DeGrisi's murder."
"So, what does that have to do with me?"
I handed him the photos of the stolen strips. "You ever see these before?" He gave them barely a glance before tossing them back to me like a fistful of spuds in a game of hot potato.
Yes, I'm familiar with them. I had them on consignment here in the gallery, up until today, that is, when I sent them out to their new owner.
And who might that be?
He plucked a piece of thread off his lapel and deposited it into a tubular wooden wastebasket that had the right proportions to be the box the stork had delivered him in. All right, Valiant. You already know, or you wouldn't be poking around here. I sold them to Rocco de Grisi. I got a check in the mail from him this morning for the full purchase price. I sent him the strips by messenger.
How did Rocco first find out you had them?
He crossed his arms and legs in the same direction, in the same motion, the way a seated barnyard tune would, except he didn't turn himself into a pretzel in the process. Through the efforts of a gentleman who earns his living matching up wealthy collectors with interesting objects. When he makes a connection, he takes a cut off each end, from buyer and seller both. He put Rocco and me together.
This matchmaker got a name?
Toner crooked a bony finger and scratched his head. Strange, but his name escapes me. I'm really very terrible with names. I keep meaning to take one of those memory courses, but I can never remember when they're being held.
A fat lot of cooperation I could expect here. So, this mysterious matchmaker showed Rocco de Grisi the photos. What then?
Rocco bought them. I sent in the works within an hour after getting his check.
How come so fast?
Service, Mr. Valiant. Service. The hallmark of my business.
I suppose it didn't have anything to do with getting them off the premises as soon as possible. I suppose you had no idea those strips were stolen?
Toner puckered his lips. Press a bugle to them, and I just knew God Bless America would come out the other end.
Stolen?
My word. Imagine that. Had I known, I would have turned the nasty things over to the proper authorities immediately.
How did you originally come to have them?
Toner swayed ever so gently from side to side. These strips came to the gallery one day via messenger. The letter with them asked if I would be interested in handling their sale. The letter stated that the strips belonged to a wealthy old family that had fallen upon hard times. This family was being forced to part with some very dear and very precious possessions, including the aforementioned strips. The letter stressed the need for utmost discretion to protect this family from the ill publicity that would certainly befall it should its plight become known. I sent the messenger back with a note informing the family that I would certainly do my best to secure top dollar for these works on its behalf.
This family have a name?
Most families do. This one never said.
How about an address?
Sorry, no. In the interest of discretion, they instructed me to send their cut to a downtown post office box.
Got the box number?
Sad to say, I do not. I'm such a nit when it comes to keeping records of such matters.
Talking to Hiram Toner was pretty much like running on a treadmill. Lots of effort, but no forward motion. A short dose of him, and I began to understand why guys go off and live on mountaintops. I'm not diddling with you anymore, Toner. I'm turning this whole sleazy mess over to the cops. Explain your nameless family to them.
He dismissed my threat with a smile almost longer than he was wide. Do as you see fit. I have no fear of the police. In fact, the police and I are old friends. They pop by and inspect my merchandise quite regularly. As you can see from the fact that I'm still open for business, they have yet to find anything remiss.
There's a first time for everything.
He turned his smile into a smarmy grin that hinted he and he alone had a foolproof method for beating the system. I wished him well in fulfilling his fantasy. When I was a kid, I patronized a soda shop where for 25 cents I got a comic book, a double-dip cone, and more candy than I could stuff in a gunny sack. A guy we called Pops ran the joint, and still does. I walked in and said hello. Pops peered at me through eyeglasses, not quite as big as my car's headlights.
Well, fiddle-dee-dee!
Pops always talked like a man with a tune caught in his throat.
a lot of hidey-hoes, by-gums, and land-a-goshens. Eddie? Eddie Valiant? That you? You got it, Pops. What's good today?
He pointed an arthritic finger at a box of candy that probably had been there the first time I came in 20 years ago, and hadn't been that fresh then.
Got some tasty jujubes and some sweet bottles.
He held up a hollow paraffin bottle filled with green syrup. The thing had been on his shelf so long the syrup had turned as solid as the wax surrounding it.
You used to like these pretty well, as I recall.
I slid a double sawbuck across the counter. Give me this many jujubes. By the look on his face, I must have just doubled his yearly gross income.
I don't think I've got that many, he said,
clearly afraid he was about to blow his biggest sale of the decade. I gave him a brand new lease on life.
Make it an assortment, then. Whatever you got. Surprise me.
He went through his boxes, picking a handful of stale candy out of each. I can't remember when I've seen anybody so happy.
You still keep up with comics the way you did in the old days, Pops?
He showed me a set of teeth with more gaps than a guilty man's alibi.
You bet your life I do. Read every one that comes out. Have to use a magnifying glass anymore to make out the words, but I keep plugging away at them. Right a Rudy.
Like I said, definitely a man with a tune caught in his throat. I fished out the burn negative I'd found in Rocco's fireplace. Know what comic this might be? He studied it through a magnifying glass large enough to have started life as a porthole in the Queen Mary.
Can't say that I do. It looks sort of familiar, but I can't place it right off. Shouldn't be too hard to find, though. Every comic company uses its own numbering system. I ought to be able to track this one down easy enough.
I pulled another 20 out of my wallet. Here's something to get you going. He made my money vanish with a skill that would have impressed Mandrake the Magician, and gave me a duplicate of the long, hard going-over I get from patrol cops when they catch me hanging around a decent neighborhood at an indecent hour.
You still in the detective racket, Eddie?
Some months more than others. This month up to my eyeballs. He picked a jawbreaker out of a cardboard box, popped it into his mouth, and poked random holes in it with what he had left of his teeth.
This comic you're after, it have anything to do with a case?
I told him it did, and I told him which one.
No kidding.
His gumball flipped back and forth between his cheeks like he had two competing Mr. Tooth Decays in there, engaged in a cannon battle over his few remaining molars.
The Rocco de Gracie murder. Do tell.
He pointed toward a section of his comic rack with more webs on it than you'd find on Spider-Man's laundry line.
I got a big bunch of his syndicate stuff over there. Hasn't been moving too good lately, and de Gracie's got this policy of no returns. You want my opinion? I say he got knocked off by an overstocked newsboy.
I patted him on the shoulder. Thanks for the tip, Pops. I'll check it out. In the meantime, I'd appreciate whatever you can dig up on that comic I gave you.
Be my pleasure, he said. Always happy to assist a force of the law. I'll get right on it.
I gave him my card and asked him to contact me when he got results. I called Big Art at the pool hall I used for an answering service. He checked behind the cigar counter and found one message for me from the Rabbit. Roger had connected with my phone company contact and discovered that the evening he died, Rocco had placed two calls, one to the de Gracie Art Gallery, one to Carol Masters' studio. He had talked to the gallery for 10 minutes and to Carol Masters for 5. I wondered what about. The Rabbit had also done some productive spade work on backtracking the tea kettle. The Alice in Wonderland prop man had bought it from a Toontown junk man, and the Rabbit was on his way to interview him. The Rabbit said he would call in later for further instructions. I asked Big Art to tell the Rabbit to check around with local messenger services and find out which one had delivered the stolen artwork to Hiram Toner at the High Tone Gallery of Comic Art. Next, I swung by the office, mainly because it boasted the cheapest drinks in town. When I pulled up outside, I found Clever Cleaver's car parked at the curb.
Since I've never been known for my good sense, I went in anyway. He was waiting for me in the hall. He'd been there for quite a spell, judging from the number of scorch marks his smoky yellow cigarette puffs had branded into the carpet. "To what do I owe this unexpected pleasure?" I asked, letting us both inside. He went straight to my bottom desk drawer, hauled out my bottle, and held it to the light. It contained enough for one whopper or two petites.
"You don't mind, do you, Butch?" he said, pouring the bottle's contents into a single glass. "After all, I am company."
I shrugged and shut my mouth to keep my tongue from licking my lips. He tossed down the last of my hooch and ejected a few projectile-shaped ear puffs, which came at me as low and hard as his next statement.
"Get off the Roger Rabbit case," he said, biting down hard on every word and spitting them one by one in my direction. "I got the wife pegged as the killer, and I'm about this near to proving it."
He sent up two parallel lines so close together, you would have been hard-pressed to pass a hangman's noose between them.
"You keep poking around. You're liable to screw up my play, and that would make me very unhappy. So lay off Roger Rabbit."
He took a pencil out of his coat pocket, underlined his words, and stuck them to my wall, where I'd have to cover them with a picture, paint them over, or spend the rest of my life looking at them every time I sat down at my desk.
"Sorry to ruin your tough guy rendition, Captain, but you got your facts wrong. I'm not investigating Roger's murder. I agree with you 100%. Jessica Rabbit did it, and I wish you all the luck in the world in nailing her for it. I'm after whoever got Rocco de Greasy." That brought him up short. "You kidding me? Roger Rabbit killed de Greasy. There's no doubt about it. Rusty Hudson put it to bed once and for all when the lab found the rabbit's paw prints all over the fatal 38.
That bit of information, which came as news to me, sure gave the case an interesting twist. I know it sounds like a lost cause, but I'm not exactly swamped with work right now, so I think I'll putter around with it a while longer.
Suit yourself. Keep chasing hobgoblins until you're blue in the face. Just don't mess me up."
Perish the thought. I would like to know one thing about your investigation, though. Did your boys search Roger's house?
You bet. They gave it a thorough going over.
Did they, by chance, take Roger's tea kettle with them when they left? Until he knew where this was leading, Cleaver wasn't so anxious to go.
His tea kettle? What could they have wanted with his tea kettle? And why do you care, anyway?
His left eyebrow assumed the shape of a hunchbacked caterpillar. I collect them, and I need the rabbits to complete my set. Cleaver scrambled the air alongside his temple.
Valiant. Sometimes you slay me.
He left me with an empty bottle and another big hole in my puzzle. 22. Carol Masters' secretary sent me to Carol's shooting location, a deserted warehouse in Hogan's Alley, a low-life section of town, where I saw enough denizens floating around to cast an urban remake of 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. I parked my car, kissed my hubcaps goodbye, and went inside the warehouse. One of the city's finest intercepted me and demanded to know my business. I flashed him my license, and he let me by. Before I had gone another 20 feet, I passed at least 8 or 9 more cops. Even for Hogan's Alley, that much security seemed excessive. I wondered how Carol rated it. Then I saw her photographic subject. None other than Dick Tracy, every cop's idol. That explained it. The precinct desk sergeant probably had to hold a lottery to select which of his many volunteers got to come over here and guard their hero's privacy. In the episode being shot, Tracy was going up against Mushface, a guy with a pug resembling a bowl of barely set Wheatina. Mushface had the drop on the ace detective, but since justice always triumphs, by the time the sequence ended, Tracy had turned the tables and was carting Old Ugly off to the hooscow. A bunch of cops came up to Tracy afterward and asked him for his autograph. While he wrote, Tracy delivered a short sermon on the importance of strict law enforcement in modern society. The cops roundly applauded. A few of them snabbed his word balloons and told him they planned to frame them and hang them above the station house door. The way the cops treated him, you might have thought he really was a cop instead of an actor playing a cop. A guy like Tracy could probably get elected chief of police on the basis of his dashing reflection in the funhouse mirror. In the comic business, they call that the power of make-believe. In our nation's capital, they call it politics. I offered to give Carol Masters a hand loading her camera stuff into her car, but I got a response so cold I was sorry I'd taken the wool lining out of my trench coat.
I can manage perfectly well by myself, Mr. Valiant.
She dragged a box of equipment out the door and across the sidewalk toward her car. She got it as far as the trunk, but couldn't lift it inside. I grabbed it, muscled it in, and did the same with two more.
That wasn't necessary, she said. I really could have done it without you.
It's great to be appreciated, I cracked. Sometimes I wonder how I keep from getting a swelled head. She pulled out the kind of key ring you usually find connected to a jailer, and opened the door to her car. She slid into the front seat, positioned the rearview mirror around so she could see herself in it, and perked up her hair with a comb.
What do you want from me now? She said,
with about as much friendliness as I used to get from my drill instructor. I leaned on her car. It needed a good wash job, but so did I. I want some more information on Rocco, that's all. The cops are convinced that Roger killed him. I think otherwise, and I'm out to prove it. She turned sideways in the front seat, giving me a great shot of the wonderful things that happen to a well-built female body when you twist it just right.
But why? Roger's dead. You no longer have a client. There's nobody to pay your bill.
So what does money matter if I can discover truth? I could tell she believed that about as much as she believed in Santa Claus, but she was sharp enough to realize that, until she answered my questions, I'd never leave her alone.
What is it you want to know?
I went around to the other side of the car and slid in beside her. I talked to Little Rock DeGreasy over at the gallery. He says Rocco ordered him to cancel your one-woman show and take down your work. Any idea why? She dumped her comb into a purse only slightly larger than Spark Plug's feed bag.
He did it to be ornery, she said, to flaunt his control over me. Rocco couldn't stand to have people cross him, and I'd been doing a lot of that lately.
How so?
My work for Toon's Rights. My support of Roger Rabbit.
She turned her palms toward her, bent her fingers forward, and examined her nails. They were far from beautiful, chipped and scratched, like the nails of a rock climber clawing toward the top.
Rocco couldn't stand uppity women. He retaliated by yanking my work.
Dick Tracy came over to the car. I'd never seen him in person before, and I couldn't believe how tall he was. Usually Toons turn actor to compensate for being shrimpy, but Tracy could look me straight in the eye with no trouble. And talk about square-jawed. I could have used his chin for a letter opener. Carol introduced us, and his grip almost broke my hand. He yacked with us for a while and impressed me as a gutsy, stand-up guy. I nearly asked him for his autograph myself. I understand Rocco called you the night he died, I said after Tracy left.
What did he say? Nothing much, really.
I started to light a cigarette, but doused it when I saw her unsullied ashtray. A non-smoker, but that didn't surprise me. I had her pegged as a woman with vices a lot more complex than tobacco.
Rocco's only reason for calling was to torment me.
He crowed on and on about how he had canceled my show. He told me he would make sure I never showed in any gallery again. It was a typically disgusting Rocco performance. I finally hung up on him. How long did you talk to him?
I don't know, exactly. I didn't look at the clock. I would guess about 5 or 10 minutes.
Anyone with you when the call came in?
No, I was alone.
After you got off the phone, what did you do?
I had a stiff drink and went to bed.
You didn't go out?
In the middle of the night? Of course not.
If she was lying, she had the technique down pat. She didn't so much as tremble an eyelid. What's the deal between Little Rock and Jessica Rabbit?
She shook her head ruefully. The poor guy loves her, but Jessica feels toward him the way she would toward a lottery ticket. If Little Rock inherits Rocco's estate, Jessica's number comes up, and she wins big. She'll marry him and live happily ever after on his money. If he doesn't inherit, she'll rip him into teeny pieces and toss him into her wastebasket.
I pulled out my notebook and read Carol the issue number I had copied off the comic in Rocco's fireplace. Any idea what comic that could be? She was shaking her head, even before I'd finished my question.
No. There are hundreds of tiny syndicates putting out comics. Each uses its own numbering system. It could be anything.
Do you know of anyone with the initials SS who may have had a grudge against Rocco?
Can't say I do. Rocco had a few tunes with those initials under contract, but they're all decent, hard workers. If you're trying to pin his murder on one of them, I think you're way off base.
I hauled out the photos of the stolen artworks. Know anything about these? She flipped through them quickly, without interest.
There's some strips I shot a while back. Rocco put them up for sale in his gallery. I heard somebody stole them.
Odd, wouldn't you say? That whoever did it stole only strips shot by you? She shrugged.
A discriminating thief. What more can I say?
She handed the photos back. Have you heard of anyone offering these works for sale or for ransom?
Afraid not. But then there's really no reason why I should. These works were never my property. Everything I shoot belongs to Rocco. It was part of our contractual arrangement, and also one of the biggest points of contention between us. I said I should have a cut of each sale. He said no.
There was nothing you could do about it?
Not a thing. He owned them, lock, stock, and barrel. Pretty much the way he owned everything in his syndicate. Pretty much the way he owned Roger Rabbit. Pretty much the way he owned me.
Sounded like a passable motive for murder, if I ever heard one. I asked her enough questions to get back around to the front side of the mulberry bush, and said goodbye. 23. I got back to my apartment just in time to spruce it up for my weekly poker game. Anything lying around loose, I kicked under the sofa. I swabbed last week's dried beer off my card table, cracked open a fresh deck of pasteboards, tossed some chips into a bowl, and threw three cases of suds on ice. Billy Donovan arrived first. Billy was a construction worker who had drifted in from the deep south. He wore bulb-toed clodhopper shoes, bib overalls, a gingham-checked shirt, and a ratty straw hat. He sucked in a long shaft of barley grass. From the shock, his country kin included, along with a baggie of homemade grits, a plug of prime chawing tobacco, and a mason jar of white lightning in their weekly Kentucky special care package. Whenever he won a hand, Billy slapped his knee and said, "Aw, shucks." On any given night, he said it a lot. For a down-home hillbilly, he played a big city brand of poker. Next came Jess Westerminster, the moneyed one of our group. Jess was descended from a long line of distinguished forebears. His great-great-great had crossed over from the old country on board the Mayflower, and had been the guy who arranged to have the nation's first Thanksgiving dinner, catered by the Toons the colonists found living here. For this, Jess's ancestor got his name in the history books. Another of Jess's relatives had imported thousands of Toons from China to build the nation's first transcontinental railroad. They became known as the Yellow Kids, and won that relative a spot in the history books, too. The last person to arrive was Harry Wayne. Harry worked in a body shop, and owned the snazziest set of wheels. It had started out life as a stock Chevy 8-stroker, before Harry took over. He chopped and channeled the body, bored out the engine, recovered the seats, threw on a set of super-wide white walls, and traded a pound of hamburger to a Toon Dragon for 2 flaming belches, which he glued to either side of the car just behind the front wheel wells. When Harry finished with it, that car went 100 miles an hour standing still. We cut for deal. I won and called spit in the ocean. Everybody anteed up. I had just dealt myself my 3rd king, and it was starting to look like one of those nights the gods smiled down on me, when I heard an ominous sound, a key turning in my front door. Right away I could see it coming, and come it did. The door popped open, and Roger Rabbit walked in. Conversation around the table ceased. My buddies stared dumbfounded at the Toon Rabbit standing in the middle of my living room carpet. Totally oblivious, Roger hopped jovially over to the card table, extended a fuzzy paw, and said, "Hello, I'm Roger, Eddie's new roommate." I could have crawled under the table and died. Naturally, nobody hustled to the front of the reception line. Billy leaned over and whispered in my ear, "What's with the Toon, Eddie? I thought we agreed when we started this game, no women and no Toons."
"Yes, Eddie," Jess chimed in. "Would you mind explaining? What's this Toon doing here?"
"Did he call himself your new roommate?" asked Harry. "You mean to tell us you live with this thing?" Were I a religious man, my conception of the devil wouldn't wear a red union suit and carry a pitchfork. He'd have long, furry ears, gnaw on carrots, and answer to the name of Roger.
"It's business, fellas," I explained lamely. "The rabbit's a client of mine. He's staying here temporarily, until I can find him a place of his own."
"You're working for a Toon?" said Jess incredulously.
"Cash me in," said Harry. "I got business elsewhere."
"Ditto," said Billy.
The 3 of them collected their money and walked out the door. I compared their cast-off hands. They were good. The betting would have been furious, and I had all 3 of them beat easy.
"I'm sorry if I spoiled your game," said Roger, in letters so hangdog I expected them to bark and chase their tails. "I didn't know you had company. If you had told me, I would have taken in a movie or something."
I made a royal mess out of putting the potato chips back inside their sack, because I kept squeezing my hand into a fist and squashing whatever chips I held. Roger hopped along after me, trying to make himself useful. I felt like suggesting that the best way to do that would be to hang himself from my chandelier.
"Your friends don't like Toons very much, do they?" asked Roger pensively.
"Not many humans do." I counted my take. What with the forfeited ante and betting on the 3 cards, I had made 6 bucks on the night, and I relied on this game to earn my monthly rent. I shut my eyes and imagined a pack of dogs chasing Roger Rabbit across a huge open field, with me close enough behind on horseback to get a front row seat at the tearing of limb from limb.
"Tally-ho," I said.
"Beg pardon?" said Roger.
"Just thinking out loud."
"Oh."
Roger helped himself to a beer, but couldn't get his fat, furry finger through the pull tab. I pretended not to notice. Let him work out his own problem for a change.
"I could never figure that," said Roger. "I mean, why humans don't like Toons? We're no different from humans, not really. We have different mannerisms, and different physical makeups, and a different way of talking, but we have the same emotions. We love and hate and laugh and cry exactly the same way humans do."
He tried his ears, his toes, and even his nose, but struck out all the way around. No part of him was small enough to fit into the ring. I yanked the can away from him, popped it open, and handed it back. No big deal. I would have done the same for any bum on the street. Yet from the way the rabbit reacted, you might have thought I'd just crowned him Little King.
"Too bad more humans couldn't have your attitude toward us, Eddie," he gushed.
"Yeah, too bad.
Because there wouldn't be a Toon left alive." I chugged my beer and headed toward my room for 8 hours of much-needed hibernation.
"Don't you want to hear what I found out about the tea kettle?"
His words circled my head and looped around my shoulders, the way a cowboy's lariat ropes a calf.
So much for resting my weary bones.
Okay, give, I said, shrugging free of his last statement. I cracked myself another beer and returned to the living room.
Tell me about the tea kettle.
Every part of Roger started to twitch. His lips, the whiskers under his nose, his eyebrows, even his two front teeth swung back and forth like a pair of mahjong tiles hung out on a wash line to dry.
I talked to the Toontown junk dealer who sold the prop man the tea kettle, and you won't believe his story.
Try me and skim it, would you? Just give me the cream.
The rabbit pumped out his words in a balloon the size of a billboard. It gave him something to hide behind when I went for his throat after reading what it contained.
The junk man told me such an interesting story that I thought you ought to hear it directly from him. So I told him I'd come over here and get you and bring you back.
Right now?
I checked my wristwatch. But my eyes were so tired I couldn't tell big hand from little.
It's the middle of the night.
He stays open late.
Nothing doing. I'm bushed. I'll go over there with you first thing in the morning.
Sure, said the rabbit gloomily. First thing in the morning.
Even before my 7-day intensive training course at the Acme School of Fine Detecting, I could have figured the rabbit had something else on his pea-sized mind.
Come on, I said. Spill the rest of it.
I don't want to bother you with my petty problems.
Boy, this rabbit really knew how to dish it out. Too bad he had never produced any offspring. He would have made a brood of bunnies one fine, guilt-inducing mother.
I told you to give me the rest of it, now give me the rest of it.
He rocked his head forward to back, making his words about as easy to draw a bead on as ducks in a shooting gallery.
I've started to have this feeling, he said, that I'm coming apart at the seams. I don't know for sure, but I believe maybe I'm preparing to disintegrate. I don't want to pressure you, but I would appreciate whatever you could do to expedite this case.
I sighed, tossed down my beer, and got my coat out of the closet. Let's go see your junk dealer, Rabbit. The junk dealer was a toon beetle, Benny by name, shiny and black with a pastel pink head. His place had no heat, so he wore a greatcoat with 6 extra arms sewn onto it to accommodate his multiple extremities. The extra arms had been scissored out of totally mismatched garments. Benny could easily have wholesaled his coat of many colors to one of those chic boutiques that charged astronomical prices for quilts, stitched together by Appalachian toon rag pickers. To fit human gloves to his 4-fingered toon hands, Benny had tied off the glove's index digits with odd bits of colored yarn. That's how toons got their reputation for having excessively poor memories, because so many of them traipsed around with string-knotted memory aid fashion around their gloved fingers. Some junk stands a chance of metamorphosing into folk art or antiques. Some junk should have been trash-smashed at the factory door and carted straight out to sea in a garbage scow. The beetle stocked the latter, and in such great quantity that a good archaeologist could have traced the decline of civilization by excavating the store's inventory. The beetle himself scuttled out from under the rubble of World War II.
"Welcome back," said Benny to the rabbit. "You going to buy something this time or just yak my ears off some more?"
He snaked one of his antennae down the back of his coat and scratched vigorously. I wondered, could a beetle have fleas?
"I'd like you to meet my partner," said Roger. "Eddie Valiant."
"Pleased to make your acquaintance, Eddie," said the beetle.
He gave me my choice of 4 hands to shake. I declined.
"I'd appreciate it if you'd tell Eddie what you told me about the tea kettle."
"Sure, be my pleasure."
The beetle sat down on his store counter, rolled backward, and went rockabye baby atop his rounded shell.
"A couple of years back I used to have this kid, a cousin to Aquaman he claimed to be, that I employed as a diver. He brought me in relics from sunken ships and such. Anyway, the kid was diving alone one day off the coast hunting for a yacht, supposedly down out there. When he failed to come in at night, the Coast Guard launched a search. They found him lying dead on the deck of his boat. Beside him was an oil drum, the last object he ever brought up. The kid had died of asphyxiation. The Coast Guard figured he came up too fast and got one of those breathing attacks divers get when they do that.
The bug tried to demonstrate by wheezing for us, but didn't have the lungs for it. Best he could do was a chirp, and a distinctly merry chirp at that.
I bought the diver's stuff from his widow, oil drum included. When I emptied it out, there was a big pile of ordinary rocks, an old scroll, and that tea kettle inside. I peddled the drum to a scrap dealer for $25. I only got 50 cents for the tea kettle. I let it go cheap, because the prop man who bought it promised me a bit part in his picture. A promise he failed to keep, I might add.
What happened to the scroll? I asked.
I've still got it somewhere around here, said the beetle. The prop man wasn't interested, so I kept it.
Can we see it? I asked.
Sure, if I can find it.
Benny waved his arms in the air until he had enough momentum built up to flip himself off his back. Then he launched into the kind of massive search the Spaniards mounted to find the Fountain of Youth. He didn't have any more luck than they did. They discovered some future Florida land grifts. He found an old piece of sheepskin rolled around a wooden stick.
Here she be.
I reached for my billfold. How much? He scratched under each of his arms in rotation. He used no deodorant. And if you ever want to experience misery, try standing downwind of somebody with 8 stale armpits.
I got storage costs, inventory, sales tax. Call it $100 even.
$100? You sold the tea kettle that went with it for 50 cents.
He shrugged his 8 shoulders in a motion that duplicated almost exactly a rippling wheat field on a breezy day.
Yes, so I did. And it's stuck in my craw ever since. $100. Take it or leave it.
I took it, and told him I'd think of him fondly every time I passed a can of Raid. Outside the shop, under a streetlight, Roger and I unraveled the scroll. Strange writing covered it top to bottom. I couldn't make out a single word.
Swell. $100 I shell out for this thing and I can't even read it.
I flipped it to Roger.
Here's your next assignment. Get this translated.
Where?
Asked the rabbit.
You're the detective, I answered. You figure it out. I'm going home to bed.
The rabbit told me he planned to stay on the job straight through the night. I guess he must have been feeling a lot of pressure to wrap this case up before he dissolved. I told him he could do whatever he wanted to, that I was going to sleep, and that I'd see him in the morning. The phone was ringing when I opened my apartment door.
Eddie Valiant,
I said, hoping desperately for a wrong number.
Eddie whoop-de-doo, said Pops from down at the soda shop. I didn't wake you, did I? I hope not, because I've got some real exciting news. I collared your comic for you, the one you wanted. I had to look everywhere, but I found it. Boy, oh boy, what a job. There weren't many printed, not many at all, but I located you one. Oh, Pops, he came through just like he promised you he would.
Great, Pops, great. I'll pick it up first thing in the morning.
I'll be here late tonight, Eddie boy, if you want to come down now.
Add somebody else out to deprive me of my beauty sleep. Thanks anyway, Pops, but I'm beat. There's time enough tomorrow.
Oh, sure. Sure, it's just that I was real tickled to find it for you, and I thought you'd want to see it right away. But you're right. Tomorrow's soon enough.
He sounded lower than my bank balance on the last day of the month. I remembered all the extra gumballs Pops had slipped into my candy sacks, the extra nuts he had put on my sundaes, the extra shots of vanilla he had squirted into my cokes. How do you ever get even, Stephen, with somebody for giving you your only fond memories of youth? I'll be there in half an hour, I said.
Land of Goshen, he prattled when I walked in. Did I have a time tracking this one down?
He handed me a comic wrapped in a plain brown wrapper. I took a look at it while he gave me a play-by-play of the rigmarole he went through to get it. Whatever he did, believe me, it was worth it. What he gave me was a pornographic piece. The smut peddlers euphemistically call them adult comics, printed several years ago by the date on the masthead. It was titled Lewd, Crude, and In the Mood, and it portrayed in graphic detail the antics of a randy female nurse. The nurse was played by a younger, slimmer, blonder, but definitely recognizable, Jessica Rabbit. The fine print inside the front cover identified the publisher as somebody named Sid Sleaze. My good old double S in person, I'd lay odds on it. That what you wanted, Eddie? Did I do good? I helped myself to a piece of rock candy, because all of a sudden this felt like a very